Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
So I actually just got my hands on the biography of Rabbi Hirsch. I can't remember who put it out, one of the English books, and a thick volume on his biography. And I was reading through a little bit. I just came across it. I was like, you know, like when I'd probably seen it before, but it didn't mean anything to me because I hadn't spent so much time studying his works. But now that you spend a little bit of time reading his works, then it's just such a brilliant insight. So I saw it, so I right away grabbed it.
Yeah, different yeshivas used to send books out.
Yeah.
I wish they would send that one out.
So, so it really filled out a little bit. I just share one brief piece of information, which I think will actually come, we'll touch on this again in his commentary. We'll get to it in a few minutes. So he left his position in Germany. He was a major, major rav of a position of 50,000 Jews in a major area, and he took a position in a much larger city, one of the major thoroughfares of Germany, but maybe only 100 Orthodox families. And he took the position in his ability to really fight off the Reform movement, which was rooted in Germany, and the background, which I never fully appreciated, was. Until the 1700s, you start back from the time of Rashi, right after the sealing of the Gemara, of the Talmud, when the early commentators lived in the Middle Ages, starting the year 1000 through 1700. So there was no concept of an organized Jewish movement that wasn't traditional. Meaning, you had Jews who weren't observant, you always had Jews who weren't observant, but the world was closed to the Jews. The Jews couldn't be part of society. They suffered from one pogrom, inquisition, crusade after another throughout all of Europe, every country that we were in. We were eventually exiled or kicked out of. It was one big bloodbath, all of medieval European history. So Jews who wanted to engage society, so the only way to do it was to leave your Judaism and to convert to Christianity. That was basically the way that it went. Or if you lived in a Muslim country. Now, there are always pockets where it wasn't that way. Spain, until the Inquisition, the Jews were the leading, played a leading role in almost all of Spanish culture as Jews, until things suddenly changed, and then that was the end of that. Rabbi Beryl Wein writes that the Spanish Inquisition was as traumatic to Spanish Jewry as the Holocaust was to Eastern European Jewry. Not in terms of numbers. In numbers, nothing will compare. But you're talking about a society that had been there for several hundred years, that had reached the upper echelons of every aspect of society. A Jew was the one who bankrolled the entire journey to America. They were, and then they left penniless, completely without anything. Half the people converted and stayed. The other half were kicked out. An estimated 50,000 Jews died on the roads just on the journey out of Spain. You talk about people who were rooted and then left with nothing. It's hard to imagine, but this is what Jewish history has been like. In America, like over the course of 50 years, like all of a sudden, like everybody's gone. Either you convert or you just leave with all your possessions, like nothing. You just clothing on your back, walking out. And that's what happened, but that was our history. But there was no concept of a movement that was going to be a Jewish movement that wasn't religious, that wasn't part of the tradition. So individuals either left or stayed, but they didn't have such a movement. Until the 1700s, with the Enlightenment, when the European world opened its doors to the Jews for the first time, where it was okay to be a Jew and be part of society, except now you had a Shabbos problem or a Kashrus problem or numerous other problems. That was the first time where we really found an organized movement to still be Jewish and not be Jewish. But that was the first time. You didn't have that for the 700 years prior. Either you didn't want to, if you wanted to engage the world, so you have to become a Christian or a Muslim. You didn't say, I'm a non-religious Jew. That wasn't going to help you. So you either left or you didn't engage the world, or depending on the time exactly that you lived. But beginning with the Enlightenment was a time where now the Reform movement was born out of that, in which it made sense to say, I'm still a Jew, but I want to be able to do things and play on the symphony on Shabbos and be a university lecturer and do all those other things. And Germany was the hotbed. That's where it really came out of. And you, for the early reformers, were Talmidei Chachamim. They knew what was going on, and they were reinterpreting everything. And Rav Hirsch went to be on the front lines, and all he was armed with was his pen. That's all he had, and all of his writings. And we've seen it already a couple of times, in which he directly engages new interpretations of non-traditional understandings, and that was his life. That's what he was. And it was the biggest issue in Germany during his lifetime. It was sweeping the country. All, like, this is a new thing. Like, it, becoming a Reform Jew was the way to go for the youth. And it was a major, major battle of, he was trying to modernize and make relevant. Like, it, to us, 1700s and 1800s is like archaic, but when you were living them, that was like the modern times. He was trying to make relevant to his generation against the tide of this reform movement, and that was his life. And his writing is beautiful, and that you see that's something. We'll see it again in a moment. That's why I'm giving this introduction now, because we're going to come across it. And that's the context in which he's writing, which is just fascinating. Okay, let's finish up his commentary. Let's finish this up.
What page are
we? We are up to page 376. We're up to verse 16. Verse 16 created a major question which we have asked. Verses 16 and 17, we'll do them together. Let's read the verses again inside to get into get back into our story here. Up top, verse 16, Vayomer, and he said, Hashem said, Binishpati Nu'um Hashem, this is the angel calling out to Avraham the second time. By myself I have sworn, Nu'um Hashem, says Hashem. Kiya, and again, if you look at how do we refer to Hashem here, God? I refer to God using this four-letter name, the Yud and the He and the Vav and the He. Whereas the whole beginning of the story, it was always Elohim, right? The name that denotes justice. So Hashem says, I have sworn, Yan Asher Asisa Sadovar Azela, because you have done this thing, Veloi Chasachto Espincho Es Yechid Yacha, and you have not withheld your son, your only son. What will happen? Verses 17 and 18. I will now, this is already, again, what we're going to see here is how the Rav Hirsch Chumash translates based on his commentary. I started reading, it's like, wait a minute, that's not what the words mean, but that's how Rav Hirsch understands them to mean. The words in Hebrew are Ki Varech Avarechecha. Now that's a double language for to bless. Barech is to bless. Ki varech avarechcha would mean, I will surely bless you. Now, he translates, as you see there, unconditionally. That is a translation based on a commentary, which we will see why that's translated that way. But as we've mentioned many, many, many times in this class, all translations are commentaries. Because by definition, since there's so many ways to read in the original Hebrew, so many nuances, anytime you choose something, you're really giving some form of a commentary, even the most literal. He's not even trying to be literal, but that's his understanding of the phrase. God says, because you have done this, literally would translate, I will surely bless you, which we're going to see why he translates it as, I will unconditionally bless you. And I will multiply your seed like the stars of the heaven and the sand that's on the sea. Vayirash zarecha, and your seed will inherit the gates of its enemies. Now the question that we had asked, and we were bothered by when every time we've read this pasuk, was this is not the first time that God has made this promise to Avraham. He's actually made this promise several times before. So it would seem odd that Avraham, after fulfilling one of the most massive events in Jewish world history, is simply given a repeat of a blessing that he had actually earned prior. Like, that's not really, like, what's the big deal? You gave me this promise already once that my children were going to be as numerous as the stars in the heaven and the sand of the sea. And now after I fulfill this and I give you my own son, you tell me that you're going to give me the same thing?
Well, but Hirsch adds unconditionally.
So now you see where he's answering. Well, in other words, that's where he's clearly what he's answering. In other words, where he sees in the double language unconditionally, as we're going to see it inside in a moment, that something has shifted in the nature of this promise. And now, it used to be contingent upon some behavior of you and your children. Now that you've done this, you've elevated where it's a guarantee no matter what. That's clearly his interpretation, and you see it in the translation, and that's the question that he is answering. And Rashi addresses, he simply addressed it by saying that it was the last phrase that's being added, that your children will inherit the gates of their enemies. That's new, and that everything else was really a lead up to that. That's sort of one of the things that he pointed out. But we're going to see in reverse that he's going to address everything in this phrase as having that new element. So let's take a look at his commentary inside verse 16. That which before had been given, everybody see where I am?
Mm-hmm.
That which before had been given merely as a bris, as a covenant, meaning refers to saying, of course this verse has been said before, that I will bless your children to be as numerous as the stars of the heaven. But it was a covenant, it was a bris of Abraham, in which you, Abraham, are responsible for certain things, circumcision, walking in my ways, following my laws. And I'm responsible for certain things. I'll increase your children. That's what a bris is. That's what a covenant is. It's we both take part. We both offer something in return for something else. However, accordingly, as something, I mean, that which had been a bris, accordingly as something completely independent of any external conditions, but still dependent on mutual fulfillment, meaning you do your part, I'll do mine, is now expressed here by a shvua, God swears. So again, Refersh is picking up on all the nuances of the language, which makes sense. What happens in the beginning of verse 16? The angel said, reporting from God, by myself I have sworn. This is new, says Refersh. We went from a covenant, which is a two-party mutual agreement, you do this, I'll do that, to an oath. God swears to do something, which is henceforth completely unconditional, which of course is noted in his translation in verse 17, that he takes a double language to mean not just I will surely do it, which we've seen many times a double language is. Here it's not just that I will surely do it, but I will unconditionally do that. Where is that rooted in the words? From the shavua, from the oath that God takes that transforms what had been a covenant into an unconditional oath, a vow that God takes that he will do so. Why, says Rav Hirsch, this is again his beautiful poetry, by the Akedah, by this binding, by this episode, Avram had already fulfilled on his side, meaning there's a deal here, right? Avram, you follow in my ways. Avram had so gone above and beyond on his side of the deal, the highest demand, and at the same time, thereby had ensured the final faithful fulfillment on the part of his descendants. You know, we are going to ride those coattails to say, why is there now an oath from God? Because we're done. We did it. Like you asked of us to follow in your ways. Abraham did it so much, we're just going to ride his coattails throughout all of Jewish history saying, we've done our part. That is the schus, that is the merit of this Akedah. By it, the spirit of the highest moral perfection was sunk so deeply into Isaac and shines forth so brightly as an example that by both, meaning by the inherited natural disposition and by the glorious example, the descendants of Isaac can never be entirely lost. Let's go over what he just said. It's so poetic. It's like sometimes you get lost in paying attention to what it means because just the language is so flowery. Two things happen with the Akedah. Number one, Avram together with Isaac, through this act, imbue, sink so deeply into their essence, this moral perfection of following the way of God that it becomes part of their spiritual DNA, so that it's passed on son to child, son to father to child, generation after generation. Every Jew who will ever live will have this part of his essence, because in his language it was like sunk into the essence of who we are as a people. We all follow the lead of our forefathers. That's why they're called the Avos, the forefathers, because in their descendants are pieces of them, so to speak, and this nature became part of them. So from the genetic DNA, and as a shining example of their behaviors, we will have this as part of us that we will never be lost. Meaning we've entered into such a covenant with God, so to speak, as a result of this act of self-sacrifice, that the Jewish nation will never be lost, which is something we first can write with great confidence in the 1800s, because look at what we had been through until that point. Now again, he's putting it in context of what he's dealing with. He's dealing with hundreds of thousands of his youth being lost to a movement which he knew meant the end of them. Their children, grandchildren, great-children will not be Jewish 200 years later. But, no matter what we face, it's part of who we are, we will never be entirely lost. Why does he write, we'll never be entirely lost? Because there's no promise for any individual Jew. No individual Jew can say, I am a Jew now, and I will be a Jew forever, and nothing that I can do can change that. Not true. I mean, you'll die a Jew, but you'll die a lost Jew. Or your children might not be Jewish. Or their children might not be Jewish. That can happen. But as a whole, the organism will never be entirely lost. So no matter what the conflict comes from, whether or not it comes from the Christians or the Muslims or from within ourselves, we have, going all the way back to the Akedah, says Rav Hirsch, an eternal promise that we will never be entirely lost. Continues Rav Hirsch, but he, again, we can stop in the middle because his sentences are 8 lines long, so we can stop in the middle and just pick it right up. But even through bypass of the deepest aberrations, no matter what happens of the Jewish people, no matter what type of aberration they might go through, will finally work their way up to the loftiest heights of their calling. It's not going to be straight. We'll have bypass, we'll have aberrations. But we will eventually, as a people, work their way up to their highest calling. Therefore, as our verse says, Ya'an Asher Asisa, because you have done this thing, because it corresponds to it, is the corresponding effect of your deed, meaning because of your actions, can I promise with absolute certainty the most blessed and most blessing-spreading future for your descendants. So that answers the first question, why is he getting this promise again of being numerous like the stars? First thing, it was a covenant before, and now God is promising, it's no longer a covenant that says you must do X, Y, or Z. It is part of who you are, guaranteed the remnant of Israel will never be lost entirely. We will always have pieces dying off, either willingly or through persecution, always. But the core will always work its way through history. It's almost like, you know, there are a lot of different ways you could visualize it, like a comet, you know, as it's flying through the sky, like sparks are flying off, and they're lost. But the essence of the comet will always continue forward. So everyone has the opportunity to say, I could either let go and do my own thing, at which point you fizzle out eventually, or you stay connected to the source. Every Jew's choice. We're given a promise for eternity. The comet will continue its journey through history. Individuals have the choice to latch on or to let go. If you let go, you'll burn for a little because everybody thinks they have their own source of fire, but you're no longer eternal if you're not holding on to the source, and you'll quickly fizzle out and be lost for all of eternity. But you can hang on for eternity, and then the Jewish people will always continue to exist. Now refers to as a magnificent piece. What's the promise that we're given? The third element, stars, sand, and now we add a third thing here. You will inherit the gates of your enemy. Says refers, beautiful. Verse 17, bottom of page 376. If here it is indicated that his descendants will also have enemies, this is just in connection with the aberrations which, as remarked on verse 16, are envisaged in Binishbati. What he means to say here is, I just promised you that you will never disappear. Hinted at in that, says Rav Hirsch, is, why would I need to promise you that you'll never disappear entirely? Because there'll be reason to think you might disappear at points during our history. The fact that I now need to swear you will never be lost, unconditionally, you will always remain, says you're going to have enemies. And your enemies are going to come because you'll have aberrations. You will have Jews from amongst your rank who are going to go off. And as they go off, enemies will come. There's going to be this cycle, all of Tanakh. All of our 24 books are filled with the Jews go off, enemies come, people die, we come back. It's a cycle. So says the first, there will be enemies. You will have fight. There's no question about that. Israel will have its fights. But finally, the gates of his enemies will fall to his heritage. But you will inherit those enemies at some point. Says Rav Hirsch, this can hardly refer to a military conquest. This is not referring to the fact that one day you will become so strong and mighty that you will finally outmaneuver them and out overpower them. No. Military victories were never Israel's calling. Hayadayim, the hands are the hands of Esav. The hakol, but the voice, is the voice of Yaakov. Our calling has always been the voice of Torah study, the voice of our prayer. That's the voice of Yaakov. Esav, it's his hands. Now we have to take up arms to fight him. That's not our calling. That's not our goal, to be militarily successful. Says Rav Hirsch, what does it mean that we will inherit the gates of our enemies? It seems to have to be taken in the same sense as that in which the highest perfection of mental conditions is repeatedly expressed in Tehillim in the Psalms as Tzadikim Yirshu Oretz, that the righteous will inherit the land, meaning that the ultimate development of the world will fall as the heritage of the righteous. All other powers and influences will have disappeared, and only what is morally right will prevail. This idea is the magnificent idea, says Rav Hirsch, Tzadikim Yirshu Oretz, the righteous will inherit the land, is a sense of, says Rav Hirsch, why does the Psalms, David, King David, does not speak about the righteous taking up arms and joining the Air Force and the Navy? It means that the world will get to a point, this is part and parcel of our Jewish heritage, the world will get to a point where what will be victorious in the world will be the righteousness of the world. That the righteous people, righteous Jews, those who stand for morality, for ethics, for that which is correct and godly, will inherit the world. That there will be a vision of, oh, I get it. That's what a human being is supposed to be. And it's not military conquest that we speak about when the righteous will inherit the world. There'll be a point in time where the world will acknowledge, they will see the veil of that which is obscuring all of that will somehow be lifted. And there'll be this moment of, oh, I get it. There is a creator. I am a created. This is what he wants from me. This is what a human being is supposed to be like. And the righteous will inherit the world. All will then give reign to the righteous because they will inherently rule because of who they are, not because of the strength they wield. Says Rav Hirsch, that's the blessing, that you will have enemies. You will have aberrations, and your aberrations will create enemies. And your enemies will attack and decimate you. You will never disappear, but in the end of days, after much suffering and tremendous bloodshed and 2,000 years of exile, you will inherit the gates of your enemies. There will be that element of the righteous coming to inherit the world. In his language, just reading that again, the ultimate development of the world will fall as the heritage of the righteous. Other powers and influences will have disappeared, and only what is morally right will prevail. The world will get to that point. First is, you know, you hang on, you bend your shoulder, you work through history, generation after generation. Eventually, that will, you know, you take a brief glimpse through history, you look back at the barbarism of, you know, the Roman Colosseum, all the way through the Middle Age time. Even the isms of the 20th century, which had all of these isms of socialism, and communism, and things come. And if you were living in that age, you say, like, when this will, it'll never end. It's impossible that this will come to an end. And then it does. Between, you know, 1970 and 2000, it's like, if you look, it's like, it's not possible that the world can change so much. Like, how does it happen? And it did. Like, before our eyes. You know, the former USSR, like, and like, with it went like a whole 100-year theology, philosophy. Impossible, right? That happened before our eyes. So they say, Iran will never get them to think differently. So yeah, that's what it looks like right now. Like, it's just impossible. So I don't know. I don't have a solution. I'm just saying history has borne itself out. The generations come and generations go, and somehow the world will progress to a point where tzaddikim yirshu aretz, where the righteous will inherit the land, and the moral development of the country will get to that place. How and when, that's our belief. I don't know. But it will happen. So that what is said here would be ultimately the shahr, the gates, the forum, meaning the social and political formation of even those nations who have fought against the principles of Israel, will come to be a heritage for Israel. That in Israel and through Israel they will obtain the blessing and happiness for which they have striven in vain in all other directions. Can you imagine a day when Iran comes knocking at Israel's gates, begging for a blessing to achieve the happiness that they've been searching for these last several decades? Right? It's unfathomable. It's ludicrous. Vayirosh zarachai sha'ar oivav. Your children will inherit the gates of your enemies. There'll be a time, says the Hirsch. And he's running in the 1800s. He's not even running about Iran. He's got other problems on his hands. There'll be a time when the enemies of the Jewish people will be knocking on our doors to receive the blessings and the happiness that they've been seeking for. And that will be the day and age. When will Mashiach come? When Iran's knocking on our door for a blessing? Well, no, but Mashiach. You should just know, by the way, that this thought, all Christian thought, not all of it, much of Christian thought was taken from our own ideas. And this was one of the major, major principles of the early Christian fathers when they ran into the problem of the Jews. Meaning, once they decided that they were the chosen people and we were not chosen, what should have happened to us? So we should have disappeared. We were dispersed, we were exiled, we didn't have a temple, and the way of the world has been for every other nation, at that point they should have eventually disappeared, because the new chosen people, the new miraculous people, were the Christians. And it didn't happen. The Jews were like this constant thorn, and they're like, why? How are they still here? So they actually came up with a concept called the Pope's Jews, that we were going to be a witness people. That we were needed to be kept around, that God was keeping us around even though He had rejected us. Because somebody had to be there to witness and say, oh, you were right, we were rejected and you were chosen. Because if the Jews disappeared, who would be around to witness and say that Christianity was right and this whole thing happened? Like, nobody would know. So God had to keep the Jews around to be this witness people, and that's one of the ways that they tried to explain the phenomena of how did the Jews manage to survive all of the Crusades and all of the pogroms. Like, how did they live through that? They should have died. Like, all the other nations of the world couldn't be able to manage that without a land, without a people. Like, that doesn't work. So there was actually a group in Rome. There were the Pope's Jews in Rome. They created a little city of Jews that were protected by the Pope. Through all the Crusades and through all the horrors of medieval Christian European history, where Jews are being slaughtered left and right, and the irony of the world, so God created a little enclave in Rome of, I don't know if it was several hundred or several thousand Jewish families who were protected by the Pope, were given this because he was afraid they were going to, all the other Jews out there, you know, are going to be dead, they're going to be killed. So he had his own Pope's Jews who were going to be protected to be able to witness the second coming and testify to the world that they were right. So that concept is really a Jewish concept in which we say all the nations of the world, all evil, all the enemies of the Jews will witness that and come to us for their blessings. The righteous will inherit the world and everyone else, all those, how did he express it? The powers and the influences of the world will disappear and they will see the truth for what truth is. But it's not going to be because of our military prowess. We might need to pick up arms and fight, but that's not been our strength, and that's not what it means that we will inherit the enemies of the gates of our enemies, but that they will come to see the truth and obtain the blessings and happiness from Israel, that who they hated and tried to destroy, when they will come in the end of days to do so. Okay, beautiful. 18. The angel then continues, V'hizbaruchu b'zarecho, through your seed all the nations of the earth will bless themselves. They will all say, you shall be like the children of Israel. Right, again, try to imagine a world where our Palestinian cousins and our Iranian neighbors will bless their children. May you be like the children of Israel. Why? Ekev asher shamata b'koli, as a result of having obeyed my voice. Now, Ekev is the name of a parsha. Ekev, as a result of having heeded my words, it appears several times in the Torah as Avram heed or listened to the voice of God. Where Hirsch is going to now discuss is that the Torah does not say the word schar, reward. It doesn't say that I will bless your children and make them as numerous as the stars and inherit the gates of your enemies because as a reward for your listening. The Torah uses the word ekev, meaning as a result of that which you did, this is what you're going to get. But it refrains, says Refersh, the Torah specifically does not use the word that it's going to be a reward, the word sechar. Says Refersh, why? Verse 18. Sechar, reward, in the meaning that we've generally attached to it, is reward for the good deeds of the righteous, yet that word hardly ever occurs in Tanakh. We don't find that in Scripture, in our 24 books, we don't find the righteous receiving reward. Sages talk about it all the time as far as in the next world we will receive our reward. But the Torah itself almost never talks about the righteous receiving or inheriting their reward. A righteous man has no loss in service of God. Now let me just give the background to what he's going to do. The concept of reward, the standard concept is you are lacking something, you have invested something, and I will fulfill that which you have given as your payment or as your reward. You have invested your time in my company, in my business. You have spent 8 hours painting my house. So you're out your 8 hours of your life. I will compensate you for your time. And compensate is really a word when you're talking about compensation. Where does that word come from in the English vernacular that we use? You gave up this. I will compensate you for that which you gave up to do whatever it is that you did. That's not a Jewish concept when it comes to the service of God. It's not that, okay, so I gave up like 2 hours of my day to build a sukkah, so you better pay me for it. Mm-hmm. That's not the paradigm that we use to understand what reward means, what that concept is. So says Rav Hirsch, a righteous man has no loss in the service of God. Not missing anything. Even the biggest sacrifice that he might make would be to him, in itself, the biggest gain. There's nothing missing. If you'd ask, you know, just going to my classic paradigm example, if the biggest, you name the person that you care about, the biggest basketball player, the biggest movie star, the biggest politician, would ask someone who values whatever that would be, you know, values some 15-year-old kid who wants to play basketball, or an actor says, I need you to come on with me to a trip, I need to drive, you know, from Atlanta to New York, he'd say, I need somebody to drive me. Are you available? Right? So would that person say, yeah, but let's see, it's going to take me 10 hours there, spend the night, 10 hours back, and gas, so okay, I'll do it, but it's going to cost, you know, I'm going to need $500 for my time. Right? Why would no one say that? I mean, I'm the one gaining. I'm not, like, losing my time. If I would ask a buddy of mine, he would say, well, it's going to cost me 2 days of travel and $100 in gas, so for $500 I'll do it. What's the nature of that relationship? How is that? What's really going on there behind the scenes? I'm giving up my time to do this service for you. It will be worth it for me if I am compensated such. The person says, I can only pay you $100. The guy says, I can't do it. Why? It's not worth it. I can't give up that much time for that little money. That's the concept of reward, payment, compensation in this world. But again, in my example, if it's a movie star, if it's a basketball player, it's the president, like, you don't ask like how long is it, how much gas is going to be. I'm the one gaining. I'll be happy to do it. I don't need your money. This is the experience. But if someone say, you're willing to drive 2 days? What a sacrifice. It's not a sacrifice. Says Rav Hirsch, a righteous person never feels a need for a reward. Because reward would have implied that what she was doing for God was in some way a burden, a giving up on his life that he should have been living in order to do this, and therefore he needs to be compensated for what he should have been doing, would have liked to have been doing. The righteous doesn't think that way. For him, what might be inherently the greatest sacrifice is really the gain. Hence, schar, the concept of schar, which again the grammarian refers, points out, is related to the words sagar, which means to close up, or sachar, to fill up empty holes or empty spaces. And first likes to point out how the words are related phonetically. So the words, just like to fill up a hole or to close up an empty space, sachar is to give reward, to fill up the empty void that was created by your giving me your time. That concept, compensation, does not exist for him as he recognizes no loss. The relationship with friends also, right? A friend, you ask a friend for a favor. I need a ride to the airport. So the friend picks you up and drives to the airport. And you take out your wallet and say, what are you doing? You say, what do you mean? It took you a half hour to drive there and drive back. I want to pay you. Say, what's wrong with you? We're a friend. Like, this is what we do. So because they don't, there's no loss. Like, all right, so I would have been doing, but wouldn't you have done something else with your time? It's, yeah, welcome to life. This is what we do. I don't feel the loss, and it's offensive to me that you're going to try to pay me $50 to take me down, like I'm a taxi cab. Right, so it's not even in my mind that you should do this or that I would think about taking it. I don't want your reward in the sense of a compensation. So therefore, the righteous who doesn't recognize the loss in the time that he spends with God doesn't have it in his mind to get some type of payment. Were he to hope for compensation, he would not be the tzaddik. Right? You show where you're holding in life by how much you're thinking you're going to be rewarded. Now, we as human beings, that's fine. We're not all righteous. But that's a litmus test. When you feel like the time that you spend cleaning for Pesach and being in shul and spending the money to buy your $20 pound matzah, and you say, like, this is as if I have the ability to make, you know, a wedding for a friend of mine. Like, it's not a burden. Like, this is what a joy. For my own child or my own parents, I could do this. This is what you do. That's the righteous's mindset of, no loss. This is what life is about, is my closeness to God and my service to Him. So therefore, the blessing that does accrue from His deeds comes to Him, Akev. The language the Torah uses is not schar. The Torah doesn't use that word. It's a word of compensation. It's a word of Akev, on the heel of His deeds, meaning it's not in His view when He did the deed. Schar is something that I'm thinking about when I'm doing it, looking forward. Akev says, it's on your heel. You had no thought about it, but now that it's done, as a result of what you did, you earned certain realities. It is not that which he had in view when he did the deed. It comes to him unsought for. He was not looking for it. He only wants to do his duty. Which is why Akev means, like, literally to deceive or to heal on his back, meaning it's afterwards. Here, so I mean, what does it mean over here that Avram, you're going to receive these blessings of Akev as a result of your actions? It refers either to all that which has just been said, meaning all this blessing comes to you and your descendants and the nations of the whole world as a result of the obedience you have proved to me. Meaning all of these blessings are going to come because of your obedience. Or only to the last, I mean, this last line of, you are just alone in obedience to me, and as a final result of that, at present, so unique with blind obedience that the whole of mankind will ultimately attach itself to the blessing-bringing ways of your descendants. Either meaning that they will connect themselves to you, or that they'll always see blessings. Refers to either, it's like all three verses that we just read, 16, 17, 18, or just verse 18. Either way, the Akev, what he's saying is, note that the Torah does not refer to reward as schar. It's not a compensation, it's Akev, it's on the heel. As a result of what you did, you've earned certain realities. Like in the same way as we would say, a friend who is willing to do that, so as a result of doing that, has earned a new relationship. Not because you were looking for that, it's because you had this relationship, you wanted to be good. What happens as a result is, now there's something new in the world. You just were willing to do this, and whatever results because of that, you don't want them not to happen. That's just not why you did it. But you did something for me. You dedicated your time to me. Now something has changed. In the way of, let's just bring an example. Let's say I have this NBA basketball star, and he needs a ride. He doesn't like to fly. He needs a ride up to New York. So he finds a kid in some local high school who's willing to do it. So he drives him up. So he's not going to give him schar reward, but as a result of what he did, what's going to happen to the kid?
He's
going to
get.
Right? I don't know. He'll be a better player. Maybe he'll have talked over some skills. Maybe his life will be changed forever. I don't know. But something will happen. So that's not schar. The difference. That's not compensating him for his time. That would be done in advance. You're thinking about that. I'm looking to it. How much time is this going to cost me? What's the compensation package? Akiv would say, after having spent 2 days with this player, I now have the skills that's going to change my game forever. So that this high school player might become, you know, maybe he'll get a scholarship to college and he'll get a real job and his whole life will be changed. So you would say, Akiv, as a result on the heels of your doing this act, your life has been changed and you're going to get a college scholarship. That's not schar. Schar would have been in front, compensating you for your time. But it's a result of the time that you spent, the act that you did, you got a college scholarship. Says God to Abraham, not as schar for what you did, but Akev, as a result of the connection you now have to me and what you've imbued into your children and their descendants forever, you will inherit the gates of your enemies because that's the result of your cleaving to me. That's what happens. You've become a people who is guaranteed unconditionally to live a life that will result in that, not because it's reward, because that's the result of what happens. That is a magnificent distinction between schar and ekev, that which you do in advance as a compensation for your time, and that which is a result of your actions, how it impacts you. But that's not because it's a reward, it's just because it does. It's just an impact that happens because of what you've done. And in Avram's case, it's impacted us and his descendants forever to inherit the gates of our enemies and to be as numerous as the stars unconditionally because of his actions. Pretty magnificent, huh? Wow, okay, one last piece and that's going to conclude it. Last few minutes. Verse 19, end of our story. Avraham then returned unto his young men. Vayoshev Avraham el ne'arav, vayakumu, they arose. Vayelchu yachdov el Be'er Sheva, and they rose up and went together to Be'er Sheva, which is where Avraham then dwelt. Says the first one, Yilchu Yachdov. And they went all together, Avraham, Isaac, and the attendants. Now, let's just point out here that Refersh is taking sides on an issue that we did not assume when we read through the verses. The verse made it sound like Avraham returned on his own and traveled together with his attendants back home, and Isaac somehow disappeared off of the place. Off of the planet. Refersh does not read it that way. He's reading it as, even though it's a singular word of an Avraham returned, that the Vayel Chuyachtov, that they went together, does in fact include Yitzhak together with the attendant. So I'm just pointing that out, even though, because we had made many comments to the contrary, that will keep us from the text, but that's how Refersh understands it. What's the significance of this, says Refersh? This is the third time we read the phrase Yachtov together. And it is the final stroke of the pen, the last move in the great story. What are the three times that we've seen the words Yachdov, they travel together? First time was?
They went.
Who's the they?
The young man, Abraham, Isaac,
and his
two. No, just Abraham and I. After they left the two alone with the donkey, Abraham and Yitzhak travel, just the two of them, and it says they went Yachdov, they traveled together. Then we have the conversation in which Isaac says, "Hey Dad, I see the fire, I see the wood, where's the kid?" Mm-hmm. And Abram says, "God will choose it for himself." And then the Torah says,
they went
together. Mm-hmm. And now we have a third time, so we have on the way before Yitzchak knows what's going on. We have on the way after Yitzchak knows what's going on, and then we have coming home after they've done the deed. Says Rav Hirsch, put this all together, you see a magnificent concept. Whereas Yachad, together, for the most part means just as an external being, together in time or in person. I mean, the singular word Yachad means I'm physically with you, I'm together with you. Yachdov indicates a rather a more internal and intimate being together. Meaning it's more an existential being together, right? We can be together in a room, like we are Yachad together now, but we could be together with total strangers in a room, and we would also use that same word, Yachad. I was in the room with 50 strangers, I never met any of them, I didn't speak to any of them, and then we left. And Yachad would be a word which would describe we were physically together. Yachdov implies we connected. We were emotionally, spiritually, we were with each other on a much deeper sense than just physically together. We were connected. So that Avram and Yitzchak were connected when they journeyed up the mountain before Yitzchak knew. They were connected after. And now the whole party is being described as connected, even with the two lads who weren't there on the way back down. Says the first, that's fascinating to use the same word of emotional connection to describe Avram and Yitzchak on the way up, and then use that same word when you include these two lads who weren't part of it. They don't even know what went on. Try to put yourself in Avram and Yitzchak's shoes on the way back down the mountain. They just went through this event, right? Which we can't even imagine. And then they meet up with a bunch of guys sitting with a donkey, right? Chewing on grass. Whittle away some twigs, like, you know, just like doing nothing for a couple of hours. Like, how do you relate to them? And they say to you, like, hey, how was it? Mm-hmm. What do you answer them? How do you deal with that after just having spoken with the angel of God these two times? How do you possibly connect with these two lads who were so spiritually unprepared that they couldn't travel with you up the mountain? Says so first, the Torah uses the word yachdav, that Avram and Yitzchak traveled back with them with the same emotional connection that they had had on the way up the mountain, just the two of them. Listen to the way that he says this. Above, right after the brackets. Above, when Avram and Yitzchak left the attendant at the foot of Moriah, and he and his son set out for their great ordeal, it says, Shvu lachem, poem achamor, you wait here with the donkey. For up to such heights, only an Avram and Isaac can wander. And of them it repeatedly says that they went on that hard path, Yachdav, together, harmoniously, with one accord. Exceedingly characteristic and significant for the whole spirit of the frame of mind, which was to begin with Avram and Isaac, does it now say here, after they had achieved the great, yes, the loftiest, height that a human being can reach, they returned to their attendants who had no clue, were not prepared for this, were not ready for such a spiritual level, and all of them, Avraham, Isaac, and the men, went together, yachdav, to Beersheva. In all other circles of humanity, after such a soaring into the proximity of God, after such elevation above everything earthly, an Avraham and an Isaac would have been so full of I and myself, or of the divine, that they would have been lost for ordinary earthly life, and for ordinary earthly human beings. Elsewhere, in other societies, says Rav Hirsch, such standing near to God, even if only presumed or imaginary, right? He's talking about other religions. Like, they're holy people who don't really do it, because we have the real God. But they presume or imagine themselves to be doing so, but even that begets such pride that one proudly looks down on other people as common mortals and avoids contact with them. Totally different from that is the spirit that should be inherited from the example of Avraham and Yitzchak. Just after they had achieved the very loftiest deed that could be made on earth, they returned to the attendants they had left at the foot of the Moriah, those who could not come, those who could not soar to such heights, and go yachdav with them. they feel themselves no whit higher than anybody else. To the true son of Avraham, everybody is equally respected in their vocation. He finds no difference between himself and the lowest hewer of wood or servant. The higher he stands spiritually, intellectually, or morally, the less superior does he feel, the less he is conscious of his own greatness. This has been a practice of all the greats of Jewish people. You hear story after story of the true great leaders of the Jewish people who relate to the simplest people that they worked with in a way of such respect. They saw the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God, and they didn't see themselves as being higher or above. And that, says Rav Hirsch, I mean, we could have read the story 1,000 times, we never would have picked up on this. The word yachtov, the same word that describes the emotional connection, not yachad, but yachtov, between Abraham and his son Isaac on the way up, which in itself was a whole story that they connected even before Yitzchak knew and after Yitzchak knew. And then that same word, how they then reconnected after achieving this loftiest plane of mankind with the attendants of the donkey who were just sitting and waiting for them to return. Rightly indeed do our sages waver as to whom to award the palm of superiority, whether to chassidus, to piety, or to another, to humility. So I'm not sure exactly what he's referring to. There's clearly a debate in the Gemara as to like what's the higher level. Is it to be a chassid, to be pious, or to be humble? Another, humility, is after all the only virtue of which a man can only be unconscious of possessing. Right? Isn't that great? He who knows he is an anav, he who knows he is humble, is already not humble. Is filled with the worst kind of pride and conceit, which is being proud and conceited how humble you are. Right? That's the worst. No, we can't stand that. What he's saying, it literally comes from the unconscious, like you really achieve such a level that you look at yourself that way, not because you're trying to be humble, but because you actually just become humble. The greater you are, this is really how I believe this works, the greater you are, the more you perceive God and the greatness of His Torah, and the more you know of it, the smaller you really see yourself.
Yeah.
You really see, like, my own faults, how much I have to work on, how little I know, how much greater than I are all these works that I'm studying. So it literally, when you really become that, you see yourself as humble, even to the person who's lower than you, but because I just know myself how much I need to work on, how little I am, so it's born out of the unconsciousness, not because I'm trying to be humble. That's the worst kind of conceit, person who's trying to play the role of humility. And we see right through that. Right? The person who's filled with that worst kind, he is always saying to himself, of himself, that he has every right to be proud, and is still so little proud. How great am I? I should be so proud of myself, and look, I'm just a little bit proud. That's the worst kind of conceit. Abraham and Isaac returned from the summit of Moriah as if they had done nothing special at all. They returned to their lads, they got up, and they went together to Beersheba. So concludes Rav Hirsch's comments on our story. Magnificent, huh?
Whoa.
Just magnificent. I'm trying to feel like I should have like thousands of drushes out of all of this. It's just like so much to... Okay.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.